But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shodell, and I'm broadcasting to you today from WHLI, and I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. A little behind the scenes is that we're not sitting together.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're somewhere in Suffolk County.
I'm actually in Nassau County, but yeah, on the phone today, doing the phone interview thing, which is always a little disconcerting, but hopefully we'll pull it off.
Yes, this will be the Hurricane Elsa edition.
Oh my God! Did you get enough rain on Friday or what?
It was crazy. I actually woke up to my basement having a little bit of water, but you know we'll survive.
Yeah, water is fire obviously you don't want, but you know water's up there. You know, it just gets in everything. You know, floors, ceilings, walls. It's crazy.
Well, who doesn't store stuff in cardboard boxes? So, you know, water and cardboard don't mix well.
No, and it's also, like, I remember when we had the big hurricane, the Superstorm Sandy. You know, I live on a salt pond out east, and I had, at the time, a bunch of books that I hadn't sold yet that were in cases of Playing with Fire books that were in cases in my garage. And I'm looking out the window, and I see the water halfway up my lawn, and it's a pretty big front lawn. I have an acre of property there, so it was about halfway up the lawn. I'm like, oh, no. You know, so I go get the hand truck, and I must have had 20 cases of books in the garage, you know, because when you write a book, after you sell, you know, 12 to your friends and family, you have to figure out a way to get rid of the other 30,000 in the garage. You know? So I'm loading all these books, sweating like crazy, you know, grunting and groaning, you know, finally get all the books into the kitchen. And as soon as I get the last hand truck of books in there, you know, I look out the window and the water recedes right back into the bay. And I'm like, are you kidding? You know? Oh, good. But thank God. I mean, we were lucky out there. I mean, I was lucky anyway. We didn't have any damage at all. Just a bunch of wet roads, you know.
I know,
but this one's a little, I mean, this one's, you know, I have a family that live in Tampa, and they kind of escaped it all and passed them by. So luckily it hasn't been too much damage, I don't think, to the eastern seaboard.
No, but my heart still goes out to those people down in Surfside in that building. It's,
oh, my God.
I mean, from the, I guess the situation where, first of all, there were people that perished, that's the most important thing. That's just incredible. And the amount of people that were saved as compared that are still possibly missing is incredible. And then you think about the remnants of the building, and I'm not on top of how exactly they were handling it, if people were allowed to go into their apartments to get possessions. But that gets kind of crazy, too, because, you know, if it's not safe, that's a bad thing. But to lose all your possessions, again, life first, no question about it. People that died, that's incredibly terrible. But at the same time, you know, I guess probably the average age of the people down there was 65 or 70. An accumulation of a lifetime of memories and mementos and even just valuable things, that's like, wow.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, you go to sleep one night and you wake up under a pile of, don't wake up under a pile of rubble. It's horrifying, you know. I kind of get creeped out when I'm in those underground garages, you know, with the low ceilings and stuff. I know it's a little bit of claustrophobia or whatever, but I don't like being in those places. It's too confining, you know. Just terrible.
Yes.
On a brighter note, I had quite the weekend last weekend. You know, 4th of July was crazy time for us. Generally not a busy weekend for restaurants because, you know, a lot of people are barbecuing and going away to traveling, whatever. But in the club business, which I'm a neophyte in, you know, seems like 4th of July is a fairly large deal. And we had a fairly large deal ourselves. We had a 4th of July party with fireworks and a whole shebang, no pun intended. And yeah, we wind up with like just short of 900 people for the party, which is always an adventure. You know, when you're catering something like that, you know, all the rules change. It's not like you're catering a wedding for 150. Once you start to grow into those numbers, things get a little interesting, as they say. You know? But we we pulled it off with a little panache, and everybody seemed happy and thrilled with what happened. But it was really funny, you know. I learned something. We had a menu of it was steaks, and we did marinated flat iron steaks. We did you know, hamburgers, hot dogs, fried chicken, you know, sort of the barbecue-y things, ribs, you know, we smoked a whole bunch of ribs up, and then, you know, the requisite corn and salads and things like that, desserts. But what I found fascinating was that very few people went for the steak. Everybody was going for hamburgers and hot dogs, and I think that's just a traditional headset that people have around that holiday. I think that's a burgers and dogs deal, you know?
You know, that's so funny you say that, because Kerry and I decided to have a barbecue for our friends on Sunday. And I had been to a friend of yours, Rob Rush's, birthday party recently.
Oh, yeah.
And
happy birthday, Rob.
There you go. And all they served was hamburgers and hot dogs. And I said, you know, for simplicity, Kerry, let's, you know, she didn't know what this, she said, let's just do hot dogs and hamburgers. And the best part of it this year was her 20-year-old son and his buddies did all the cooking. It was a wonderful experience.
That's a great part about having stuff that's not as exacting, you know, on the grill, is that you can put the amateurs to charge and kick back. You know, it's great. But yeah, we went through, I don't know, I must have gone through 600 hamburgers, 650 hamburgers, whatever it was. And it was crazy. And you know, now the interesting part about, you know, being in the food business is, you know, like in restaurants, you have no idea who's coming. You have no idea what they're going to order, right? So it's always a big guessing game on what to bring in to the restaurant and how much. When you have a party like that, you kind of know how many people are coming, and you kind of know what they're eating to some degree, you know. But I was totally tricked, because I thought that, wow, you know, for the price, and the price was, you know, fairly up there, 110, 120 a head or whatever, you would think people would go for the more expensive items. And I think that's just a natural inclination for people. But no, they went. It was burgers and dogs, man. I mean, they just ate a bunch of burgers and dogs. And we went through, you know, a fair amount of fried chicken, a fair amount of ribs. But the steaks, no way. And, you know, you have to, now, you know, now I've become less of a chef and more of an alchemist, because I have to kind of weave all of this stuff into gold here, because, you know, we have a bunch of the, you know, the steaks that we ordered that weren't cooked and left over. But I mean, they're fine, but you have to find a way to sell the rest of them,
right?
So it was an interesting weekend in that regard. And the funny part was, we had, you know, we had the party scheduled for Saturday, and Mother Nature, you know, who happens to be the senior partner, by the way, Mother Nature said, you ain't doing this Saturday. There's no fireworks. It was raining. It was terrible. So we at the end of the day, we postponed it till Monday. And what was interesting was, I thought we were going to lose reservations. I was panicking a little bit, because, you know, I had all this food ready to go. And they changed it to Monday, and we actually increased the amount of people that were coming to the party. So it all worked out in the end. And, you know, we had a happy 4th of July. Everybody saw the fireworks. The kids were all excited. You know, the kids, I'm talking from, you know, 85 down. And it was a fun night. It was a fun night for everybody. We had it organized pretty well. We had three grill stations out there where, you know, people could go, and they were kind of assigned a red, white, and blue area, you know. So it was all a big, fun, festive, good time for everybody to kind of send the 4th of July weekend out on a happy note, you know.
No, that's really nice. It's funny. I don't know. It seems like we're in a mode now that people just want to gather and celebrate and be together. And again, most people are doing it responsibly, so that's a good thing. But my memory goes to the country club scene. And way back when, my family lived near Engineers Country Club. And country clubs at one point were going through some growing pains, I guess. And they were accepting people, not for a traditional membership, but just a dining membership.
So, yeah, house member, they call it.
So we would go on Sundays for the lobster bake, and oh my goodness, I never saw anything like it. People would grab a whole steamed lobster, they'd rip off the I guess, the abdomen and just keep the tail and throw out the rest. There was so much decadence. It was really, really, really crazy. But that theme always continues, because I've been to a couple of political fundraisers, and they've had their summer lobster bake, and I've never seen people so skilled at balancing three or four lobsters on a plate. It's just amazing. what people do.
They train in Africa with those ladies with the fruit baskets on their head. You know, they do like 2 weeks in Africa to be able to get that stuff down. You know, it's funny. This is why, you know, a lot of the country clubs are struggling, you know, and some have actually gone broke, you know, because of all the silliness that, you know, that was the kind of the norm in country clubs for all those years. I mean, they had the bread bars and the free nuts everywhere. And, you know, everywhere you went, somebody there was a bag of nuts, a goldfish, or this, that, and the other thing. And they were kind of bullied by their catering business to some degree, you know, like the weddings and things. And once that dried up with COVID, two or three of the clubs got in real trouble. And so I think what's happening now, and I'm probably the foremost example at the moment, is that the clubs are hiring different, you know, more restaurant-oriented chefs to hopefully, you know, bring the food into the 21st century, and also kind of take a look at the finances, because, you know, those clubs, that, you know, they're non-profit, so you got to kind of be careful. I mean, you don't want to, you know, make a lot of money with them. You know, it has to, you know, something has to go back to the members, you know, in the form of, you know, maybe a little less of a price on some things or some perks here and there. But at the end of the day, I mean, you can't run 70-80% food costs and expect the club to survive. A lot of these clubs, you know, at the end of the year, they'll have a deficit of $500,000 or $1 million. And, you know, at some point, you know, it's like the government. You can't argue with math. You can pretend that 1 and 1 is 11, but at the end of the day, it's 2. And at some point, if you spend more than you take in, you know, it's gonna be a problem for the person who's doing it. And, you know, we see that in government, and you see it in business. I mean, you know, the only two entities that spend more than they take in are the United States government and the restaurant business. It's the only thing they have in common. It's hilarious, but it's true. And you can't. That's why the failure rate in restaurants is in the 90 percentile rate. They don't have the ability to print money like the government has and lie about it or whatever they do, and, you know, and kind of finagle around and borrow whatever happens. But, you know, the bottom line is you can't spend money to take in. It's just, it's math. It's simple math. And I think the clubs have been doing that for years. A lot of them have, you know. But I think they're coming around to an awakening where they're going, okay, we can't operate like this anymore. And some of it is so silly. I mean, the club that I'm affiliated with at the moment, they used to have a bread bar every day for lunch, right? So they would have like an entire, you know, 16-foot table loaded with pumpernickel and rolls and rye and whole wheat, so you could pick it out for your sandwich or toast it for your eggs. I mean, you know what happens to bread after you leave it out for a day, right?
It gets a little stale.
Yeah, it goes in the garbage. I mean, so there was this tremendous amount of waste. I mean, you know, and we were able to kind of get around that because of COVID. Well, we can't have a bread bar anymore because you can't have people walking up there. Yeah, that. So we eliminated that. You can't have nuts out at the bar all the time because you don't want somebody else's hand, you know, in the bowl, you know. So we were able to, you know, thin that out a little bit and kind of acclimate the clientele to the fact that, you know, some of this stuff is going to stop. And they've been pretty cool about it, you know. And I think that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, at the end of the year, there was a whole lot less money lost than before. So, you know, I think heading in that direction, I think a lot of the clubs are going to start to change. And you also have, you know, a younger clientele in the clubs now that are demanding a different thing. You know, a different type of food. It's not the stodgy or old, you know, club sandwich, egg salad thing, you know, prime rib dinner on Saturday night with the dance and things that was going on, that were going on in the clubs for years. You know, it's changing a lot with the younger breed. They want newer stuff. So, you know, when I got to the club, my mandate was kind of like, I'd like them to feel like this is being put on their regular restaurant rotation. You know, everybody has, you know, 5 or 6, 7 restaurants that they go to on a regular basis. And I didn't want people to feel like, oh, my God, I got to go to the club because I have to make my minimums. Or, you know, I wanted them to go because it was an exciting place to eat, you know. And I think we've gotten to the point where, you know, member business is up a lot. And I think a lot of that has to do with what we're doing with the food and wine. I mean, some of it's COVID and some of it's the fact that everybody's out and about again, you know. But, you know, they're showing up for the nights that we have dinner there, which is kind of important to me because, you know, A, I have an ego, and B, I have food I got to sell. So, you know, you want that to happen. But I see a change. You know, they hired Blake Verity, my friend Blake, who's a fabulous cook, you know. He was over at Piping Rock for all those years. Alex Lee was in, I think, Glen Oaks for a long time. You know, so they're starting to, Richard Allen, another very, very talented chef. He was down at Sea Wayne. So I think they're starting to change their thinking as far as not having, you know, guys to just babysit a formulaic kitchen that's been operating like that for 25, 30, 40 years, you know, because that crowd is dying off and the new, you know, as you know, as it happens in nature, new kids are coming in and they're used to, you know, eating out in these 3 and 4 star restaurants up here on the North Shore, especially. And, you know, I think they want a different thing. So that's where we come in and hopefully we provide that.
Very cool. So I just got a news alert. I gave much too much credit to Elsa. She is not a hurricane. She is only a tropical storm. So I apologize.
I don't know if you noticed, but I'm a hurricane. You know, my band is called Hurricane. So.
Wow, there you go. And a great band it is. I'll never forget them having to close down the beach, and you still playing over at Jones Beach a couple summers ago.
Yeah, yeah, it was fun. You know, it's been a fun ride. I mean, we haven't, you know, the band's kind of like gone by the wayside a little bit because Brian moved to Florida. You know, it's like, you know, as we're getting older, you know, the other guys in the band, Bosco and James and Michael, have this thing called the Unsung Heroes. And if you like kind of, it's a little acidy, jazzy kind of thing, but they're phenomenal players, just absolutely great musicians. And they're mostly on the East End, but if you see the Unsung Heroes anywhere, go check them out. They're phenomenal players. I mean, I felt privileged to play with them. I'm not a very good guitar player, but by the standards that these guys have, I mean, Brian and Andy Alador, who plays with us once in a while, he's the senior editor for Guitar World magazine and just a monster player. He actually plays with Dickie Betts in Great Southern, the guy from the Allman Brothers. So that's the level of guys that I was involved with. And I think the only reason they let me be in a band is that I don't smoke weed, and I was the only one that could remember the lyrics.
Don't underestimate your contribution. You are an excellent guitar player. You have an incredible stage presence, and that's what it takes to be a musician. And so
yeah, it was a lot of fun. I got to tell you a quick story about music, though. It's funny, you know, I've been around great players my whole life. This is a food, wine, and lifestyle show, so this is the lifestyle part. You know?
Nice.
That's the food part. But Stephen Vai is arguably one of the top guitar players on the planet. And his talents are just astronomical. He's just an incredible player, Steve Vai. And he's played with, you know, David Lee Roth and Whitesnake, and he has his own thing. He started out with Frank Zappa.
And so, I only learned last night that he played with David Lee Roth. It was the anniversary of some album that I guess David Lee Roth did, and I never realized that Steve Vai was a part of his support band.
Yeah, no, he was the first guy that played with David Lee Roth when he left Van Halen. But anyway, so Steven's a friend of mine forever, right? I know his family since he's born. His older brother and I have been friends since kindergarten. And, you know, two more opposite guys you never get, Roger and Steve. They're hilarious because, you know, Roger's this big, gruff, outlaw biker guy, and Steven's, you know, a vegetarian, you know, a mystical guitar player. You know, it's funny how the gene pool works or doesn't work sometimes. But anyway, so when Steven was being, and this is related to food, too, food and music, when Steven was being inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame, he needed somebody to do the induction thing, you know, to give the little speech and introduce him. So he asked me if I would do it, largely because I have a big mouth and I'm not shy. So I said, sure, I'd love to do it. So it was funny. It was in the Space, which was the old Westbury Movie Theater on Post Avenue in Westbury, which is kind of poetic because, you know, we grew up in Carl Place right next door. And, you know, I used to watch Frankenstein movies there all the time as a kid. But they converted into this concert venue, and it's this beautiful place. And so there was a whole bunch of people being inducted. And I got a call from the guy the night before and saying, Mr. Chardell, could you, you know, do the volume of people we have, could you please, you know, keep your speech to 2 minutes and under? I said, well, I can do that for the first 2 minutes, but, you know, I don't know what's going to happen after that, you know. So anyway, we had to meet two blocks behind the theater. So Gene and I went to, you know, and they had these ZZ Top cars, you know, these old classic, you know, restored vehicles that, you know, with the flames on them, they're the 30s. They were just gorgeous, you know. So they get Steve, his wife, Tia, and Gene and myself into one of the cars, and they drive us around a block, you know, to arrive, you know, and walk down a red carpet, which was hilarious, you know, because it's all fake, you know. So we get there. It's not like my car. So there's a driver, Steven, and Pia and Gene and I are all in the back seat. So we pile out of the car, and we get to the red carpet. And Steven's walking ahead. Steven and Pia are walking ahead, and Gene and I are behind him. And everybody's waving, hey, Tom, what's up, Tom? And I'm laughing. He turns around and he goes, hey, this is supposed to be my night. Everybody knows you and not me. I'm like, well, you know, they all eat three times a day. You know, you put out an album once a year. You know, who's going to get recognized here, you know? So we're laughing about it. We get inside. And to make a long story less long, it's my turn to get up there, right? So they announce, you know, Tom Shawdell, you know, they invite Steven. And there's all kinds of, you know, celebrities and musicians out there, you know. So I said, I got to tell you a story about Steven. I said, first of all, he's probably discouraged more guitar players than he's inspired because he's so good that you look at him and you go, what's the point? You know, you sell your guitar and take up the saxophone or something. So anyway, I said, so Steven's brother calls me one day at work. And he says, listen, you have to come over here. Steve is making Veal Cordon Bleu for Mom, and he wants your opinion. I said, you know, it's not like I have nothing to do here, Roger. You know, he says, no, but, you know, if you get off work, whatever. So anyway, I go over there. I go to the house. And I walk into the kitchen in his mother's house in Carplace. And there's Steven, you know, the rock star, standing there covered in flour, eggs dripping off his hands. He's got breadcrumbs from one end of the kitchen to the other. Like, the place is a complete mess. And he's standing there, and he's holding this completed dish of veal parmesan. And he calls me Tommy, because everybody who knows me from Carplace does. He says, Tommy, you got to taste this, man, and tell me what you think. So I taste the veal, and he goes, so? I said, you know, Steven, I've been wanting to say this to a professional musician my whole life. Don't give up the day job. Just looked at me and what? I said, every musician I've ever said to me, whatever you do, don't give up the day job. Because, you know, it's so hard to make it in music and you're not that good or whatever, you know. I said, oh, he's just scratching an itch for me. I feel like I need a cigarette right now. You know, I'm so relaxed. He was laughing. So we had a good time today. He was inducted, and all went well after that.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Yeah. So
Go ahead. No, I had nothing to say. I was just going to mention.
So I have to ask you two subject matters. So the first is
easy for you to say.
There you go. In Newsday, there was an article about a restaurant out in Aquabog called the Barrow Food House.
Barrow House.
And they talk about a sandwich, and I'm just curious, what's it all about? It says fried chicken thigh sandwich with chilled butter, cabbage slaw. So now cabbage slaw I can figure out, but what's special about chicken thigh, and what is chilled butter?
Chilled butter is probably just cold, you know. I'm not sure what he means by that. The value of chicken thigh, as opposed to breast, in my humble opinion, is that it's much better, and it has a little more fat in it. It's tastier, and it's less dry. It's juicier. You know, I do chicken sandwiches. I brine them in pickle juice, believe it or not. And I'll take we'll buy, you know, pickles for the sides of sandwiches, hamburgers, whatever. The juice that's in that pickle jar that you have at home, for me it's a bucket, you know, but that juice, rather than throw it out, I'll take chicken thighs and I'll leave them in that juice for, you know, 2 days or something like that, and I'll take them out, I'll dry them off, and I'll dip them in a batter or a flour or whatever, and fry those for sandwiches, it gives it this kind of pickly kind of cool flavor, not so much where, you know, you feel like you're biting into a sour dill. It just has this enhanced, you know, sourness, dilly flavor, you know, and it's kind of cool. But I think the chicken thighs, if you're going to make a sandwich or a brochette, like a skewer or something like that, chicken thighs are the way to go because they have so much more flavor than the breasts. You know?
So I've discovered.
And I was always a leg guy, you know. It's just a natural. I think that, you know, when you the same thing with turkeys, the thighs, they just have this amount of flavor that the breasts don't have, and the breasts tend to get a little dry if you're not careful.
So I realized that what the real recipe is, I need to get new glasses because it is tart chili butter.
Oh, there you go. Now that's different, you know. That's got, you know, probably when it says tart, I'm assuming there's an acid in there, and I'm going to guess it's lemon or lime, you know. And chili, you know, could be a couple of things. It could be chilies, you know, like in jalapeno or, you know, Fresno or habanero or any of the other, you know, myriad chilies out there. Or it could be like a chili powder. It could be a, you know, a dried spice thing that's, you know, spicing up the butter. You know, my daughter eats there all the time because, you know, she lives in Jamesport. And I've been to the Barrel House, and they do a great job there. And what's interesting about Barrel House is when you go in there, it's the first floor of a house, I believe the owners live upstairs. And it's really kind of a cool place. You know, you have, you know, this little, like, food bar where you sit at the bar and you're overlooking the kitchen. And then they have a couple of tables. But it's largely takeout. And there's no knives, forks, silverware, plates. It's all on paper. I think it's a pretty good kind of concept, and I think you're going to see more and more of that as it goes. You know, I'm starting to believe that, you know, restaurants the way that I do them, you know, like the higher end, you know, fussier service thing, are kind of going the way of the dinosaur to some degree, you know, because of the labor shortage. You just can't find people, you know. And I think everybody's feeling it. Every restaurateur that I know is looking for cooks and waiters. I know Billy Holman, who owns Market Bistro in Jericho, a dear friend who I play golf with every Monday. He can't open on Sunday because he doesn't have enough wait staff. So he had to close one day a week, you know. And it's just the whole business is like that. I mean, you know, most of my guys are on overtime because I can't find people to work.
So I got to ask you, you know, out in Montauk, you're obviously pretty familiar. You talk about Montauk all the time.
Sure.
My recollection, and even on the Freeport Nautical Mile, there would be a lot of exchange students from Ireland that would be coming over each summer and experiencing, you know, life in the United States. But with the pandemic and COVID, I would have to imagine that population is not available right now.
Well, for two reasons. You know, when I was out there, they used to come all the time, and that was started by the Gossman family, who owned Gossman's Dock out there. And they would start, back in the 60s, they started to bring kids over, you know, from Ireland. And they would come every year until the Irish economy got better. And there was no work for them. Ireland was a disaster economically, and now it's much better, so you get fewer and fewer people. But the Irish were great. I mean, I actually had both of Albert Reynolds' daughters working for me when he was a prime minister. Now, can you imagine Chelsea Clinton doing a bus girl gig somewhere? And, you know, it just wouldn't happen here, you know?
No, not at all.
No, and they're the nicest kids. They would come over, and you'd know them right away because they would fall asleep on the beach and, you know, and burn themselves to a crisp. They had all these red-faced kids trying to hitch a ride. Hilarious. And I had a very good friend, Jerry Smythe, who passed away, unfortunately, from cancer. He was a young guy too, and he lived the endless summer. He was the son of a barrister over in Dublin, a kind of a high up guy in the government too, a lawyer. And he was just this screw up, you know. He was the most fun guy you could hang out with. I mean, drank himself silly, you know, surfed in Australia all winter, came to Montauk in the summer. He was a complete mess, but a bartender and a great guy and a lot of fun, you know. But you know, the problem with the Irish kids is you couldn't schedule them for work before 2 p.m. They were out every night partying. It was hilarious, you know. I had this one guy who worked for me, Seamus, who he was about 5'2" and about 102 pounds, you know. And as soon as he got a snootful of Guinness, he turned into like Hulk Hogan, you know. It was crazy. But so my band was playing at one of the dock bars in Montauk, and so all the kids used to come down and see us play. It was a fairly busy place, you know, and we had a pretty big draw. So a couple of hundred people in a place, and Seamus is making a complete fool of himself. You know, he's black, and he's, you know, break dancing and, you know, yelling and screaming and carrying on. So Freddie, the bouncer, who was this, he was a black guy from Trinidad, and just, he looked like he was carved out of marble. He had muscles on his muscles, and the nicest guy. Freddie used to work for me once in a while, too. And we were dear friends, you know. And he was just this big, hulking guy, right? So he'd come to me and he, with the accent, he'd shuffle, "I got to tell you, man, Seamus, he be coming a pain in my rear end all night. I got to keep talking to that boy. I'm going to have to tell him to go." I said, "Freddie, just be kind to him. I mean, he's just drunk, whatever. Just tell him to calm down. He'll be fine." So he goes over and says, "Listen, Seamus, I know you work for Sheffield, but you got to calm down." "All right then, Fred. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine." You know, so going back and forth. An hour later, Freddie comes over and he goes, "Listen, I can't take it no more, Sheffield. I got to tell him to go. He has to go." I said, "All right, just, you know, just tell him to go. He'll be fine, you know." So Freddie goes over to him very kindly. I'm on a break. I'm kind of standing behind Freddie in case anything, you know, starts to happen. So he goes, "Seamus." Now, Freddie's 6'2", 220 pounds with a 28-inch waist and arms the size of my legs, right? He's the kindest individual. He goes, "Seamus, listen, I know you work for Sheffield, and I think you had too much to drink tonight. But listen, I'm not saying you can't come back no time soon." He said, "But tonight you have to go home. You had too much to drink." Seamus looks at him and goes, "All right, then, Fred, I'll be leaving, but you can kiss me arse on the way out." Like, oh, no. Freddie looks at me and goes, "What?" I'm like, I don't even know what to say, Freddie. I'm laughing so hard I was crying, you know. I said, "Who says this?" And it reminded me of a poster I had in my bedroom when I was 14 about the hawk coming down at the mouse, you know, with the talons extended and the mouse looking up and giving him the finger, you know. It's just hilarious. Anyway.
So listen, I got to throw something at you. Tell me what your first thoughts are. Tomato ketchup with black summer truffle.
A little overwrought, you know. I mean, tomato ketchup is, to me, is such an acidy flavor that I don't think the truffle thing really kind of goes with it. I would have to taste it to see, but my first inclination would be no, don't do that.
Okay. It's a summer item on the shelves at Trader Joe's. It intrigued me. I did taste it. I thought it was okay, but, you know, I wanted to get your take on it. Go on.
No, I was going to say, there's a couple of flavor combinations that, you know, people try and put together for whatever reason that just don't make sense to me. I mean, that would be one of them. The other one, I was saying this to one of the bartenders the other night. They were making an espresso. And everybody seems to expect a little, like, twist of lemon, you know? When they serve the espresso, they get this little lemon twist with it. And I'm thinking, has anybody ever put lemon juice in their coffee? I mean, it's the worst flavor combination I could think of. Who wants lemon in their coffee? I don't want sour coffee. It can be sour enough, you know? It's just bizarre. And I think that people do this for, you know, either out of habit or, you know, with the espresso thing, or out of this need to kind of create the missing note, or, you know, this imaginative, creative guy, I'm going to put black truffle in the ketchup. It just seems there are better places to land the black truffle than,
you know, it's funny. My mind wanders because, yes, I guess a lot of times when you get that little cup of espresso as you know, part of dessert, there's a piece of lemon in it. Yet when I have or I see the ladies, because it seems like more of a feminine drink, the espresso martini, you never do see a piece of lemon in that.
No, it's the worst flavor combination ever. I mean, think of, you know, having a cup of coffee and biting into a lemon. It's just, it's dopey. I don't get it. Now, so, I'm getting mad now, by the way. I'm getting PO'd here.
So I need your take on this. I need your take on this. I actually had to entertain over at Anthony Scotto's place, Insignia, out in Smithtown recently. And a couple of questions I need to go over with you. Number one, I saw this line item on my bill for a service fee. What's that all about?
Well, usually, sometimes for parties of more than eight, restaurants will add a 20% gratuity.
That's fine.
Yeah, I think that might have been what it was.
No, they did an 18% gratuity. It was a large party. It was like 40 people involved, but there was a very expensive service fee, and I wondered where that goes because I might have been a little indignant in that, you know, they said the tip is included. If you'd like to offer more, please feel free to. But when I saw that service fee, I said, whoa, I don't think I'm going to. And then I actually felt bad because I was taking out my displeasure with the restaurant on the staff, and so yeah. I apologize about that, and I will rethink that in the future. But I actually wanted to just go through the experience there. So again, we had an open menu for this large gathering of people, and I quickly learned that most people have no shame about ordering the most expensive thing on the menu.
Absolutely. Oh yeah.
So it turns out, you know, Insignia has all the regular things, the ribeye steak, the porterhouse. They didn't have a New York strip. For some reason, they call it a Kansas City strip, but I assume it's the same basic thing. And then...
I think the Kansas City has a bone in it.
Oh, okay. And then you get to the Kobe steaks, $40 an ounce, so you can get an individual 4-ounce Kobe steak for $1.60, a little pricey. Or if you get extravagant, you go for the Kobe Tomahawk steak, which serves 2 or 3 people and was probably about just under $300.
Yeah.
But they start wheeling these Tomahawk steaks in, and the servers are in gis, and they have samurai swords on their waist. And they bring the steak to the table, they whip out the samurai sword, and then they slice. I never saw anything like it. I mean, it was really, really intriguing. And they served the Kobe steak with some sort of sweet, pungent steak sauce, not like the traditional ketchup and horseradish type.
Yeah, they probably got hoisin in there or something.
Very, very tasty. I have to say, the meal was incredible. The steak was so well seasoned and cooked or whatever. I'm so bad. You know, I usually will order a steak medium well. I did err in a better way by going with medium, but I think the Kobe steak medium rare was probably the best choice, and I know for future if I ever can partake again. But talk about decadence. Oh my God, it was crazy.
Well, yeah, that's what steakhouses sell. I mean, Anthony's he's an interesting guy, and I think he does steakhouses real well. I'm not so sure about a samurai named Pedro, but you know, that's just all flash, and you know, and so they take out the torch, and they start.
Oh, they did that
at the table. Yeah.
They had the bacon on the clothesline, and they didn't take out one torch. They torched it with two torches. It was like a boxer, right, left, jab, hit. The other thing that was crazy. Fantastic presentation. It tasted great. And then they had a special for the evening of some sort of lobster roll that was incredible. But, you know, they showcased that. And, of course, that's what everybody ordered. And it was, you know, top of the line, you know, on the sushi menu. But I have to admit, the food was incredible. The service was very good. It really was a great night. But not something that I expect to be able to do again in my life.
Well, the service charge is probably for the samurai guys. You know, somebody's got to pay for those sword chops. Yeah, it's I don't know. To me, that stuff is fine. I mean, it's kind of a takeoff of what, you know, the old French restaurants were in the 40s and 50s with the tableside service and the guys, you know, doing a crepe Suzette, lighting them on fire. It's all flash, and it's fine. It's fine. I mean, to me, it's a little cartoonish, you know, when you bring the samurai guy out for the Kobe. And, you know, Kobe, you know, you say it's pricey. It's really not. It's what it costs. And I think that's where some people either don't realize what they're getting into, or I read some of these reviews sometimes on these sites like Long Island Kitchen Confidential or Tri-State Restaurant Group or, you know, all these pseudo restaurant critics. And most of these reviews always come down to, in my opinion, I see people who are in restaurants that they shouldn't be in because they're not comfortable spending that kind of money. And it's fine if that's not your thing. If you're not willing to spend, you know, $65 on a ribeye or $70 on a ribeye, then you shouldn't be there. You should maybe go to a place that has, you know, maybe an Outback or something. I'm not being a smartass here. It's just, you know, where it's not as expensive and the quality isn't the same. It's not prime. It's, you know, it's maybe Choice, which is fine, or Angus, which is fine. But the prime, if you want top-of-the-line stuff, there's top-of-the-line prices. And then I think what happens is people start to get that diminishing returns thing when they see the check, and it was basically a steak. Yeah, okay, it is what it is. It ate better than the Angus, and you can have Angus steaks that eat just as well as the prime sometimes, you know. But I think these people get PO'd because the price goes up. It's like a Ferrari. Is a Ferrari overpriced? You know, is a Mercedes overpriced? You know, is a Lincoln underpriced? You know, where is your barometer for, you know, measuring that? You know, Ferrari, there's value in a Ferrari if you can afford it. They're well made and they run good.
I think you have to be pretty open-minded. I mean, I've had a good run lately. I was able to dine at Rothman's over in East Norwich recently, had the New York Strip. Oh, my God, it was incredible. You could cut it with a fork. It was perfectly seasoned. It came out, you know, just the way I wanted to have it. It was nice and pink inside and nice and just... I'll say braised, but I'm wrong. Seared on the outside.
Yeah.
Incredible. And then, again, the experience over in Signia where the steak was unbelievable. Again, I have trouble trying to figure out if it was the psychological aspect that, you know, the ambiance and everything was right, the service was right, it was high-end, so my guard was down. But to me, I had two meals that were incredible. Yes, they were high-end, and I'm sure I can find a steak restaurant that's not as expensive and probably have a great meal, but it was incredible. It's funny, in my family, the go-to steak for a celebration is always the Porterhouse, and I, after having what I had the past couple of nights, it's just a total different experience. A sliced steak as compared to a full steak that's brought to the on your plate is just very different. I find that.
I think if you want top of the line experience, you have to expect to spend top of the line money. I mean, everything's expensive now. Food is up. I mean, people who shop know that. Food is up. You know, fish is up, labor's up, everything's much more gas, you know, everything's up, you know, and that has to be reflected in the price. When I see these people writing that this was overpriced, that was overpriced, based on what? They don't know what stuff costs, you know. They just know that it's too much for them, which is fine, you know. So don't go to that place and tell everybody how terrible it was because you were uncomfortable spending $65 for a steak. You know, if you want to spend $35 for a steak, go to a place where they sell them for $35. It's pretty simple, you know. I get incensed when I hear this overpriced thing because what does that mean, really? That means that you think that he bought it for a certain amount of money and is making too much. Well, what are you jealous of him for? Have you paid his bills, his local? My LIPA bill at Jewel was $15,000 a month, you know. The rent was $45,000 a month. I mean, people don't understand what the costs are in this business. They look at a steak at $65, a lot of money. Well, for you it is. For Bill Gates, it isn't. You know, so it depends on, you know, what your spending capabilities are. I've spent stupid amounts of money on food and wine, you know, and I watch people spend stupid amounts of money on golf clubs that can't hit them. And I'm like, well, what's the f*** in that? I mean, you know, but it's your thing, you know. My thing is food and wine, you know. I don't mind spending $1,000 on a bottle of wine if it's what I want at the time, you know. And I don't do it all the time. I can't. But every once in a while, you know, somebody would say, well, I had a wine that was just as good for $45. Well, maybe you did. What's the difference? This is what I like. This is Bacchanalia for me, you know. And there's always that kind of justification in your head for, you know, not spending as much and getting as much. You know, like, you know, I have a Volkswagen. I get there just as well in the Volkswagen as you could in the Ferrari. Yeah, but not in the same time frame. You know? I can get to Jones Beach like 14 seconds. You know, it takes you 20 minutes. You know, whatever. You know, but the bottom line is there's value in the upper end too, and it just doesn't appear to be that way for people who can't afford it. And I get that, but at the same time, you know, don't go knocking it because you can't afford it. I see it with guitars all the time on Facebook. You know, they knock these expensive guitars, these guitar players, and they knock them because they can't afford them. They're not bad guitars. You know, John Mayer plays one. Carlos Santana plays one. The Paul Reed Smiths, you know. But they're pricey. You know, they can be $10,000, $12,000. The average working musician can't afford that. I get it. But don't knock it, you know. It's just, I'm done. I was mad.
No, it's funny. I'm giggling because down in Florida, we have friends that they worked hard in their life. They developed this really large insurance agency, and they can afford a very luxurious car when they're down visiting in Florida, yet they drive around in a little red Volkswagen Beetle, and it's nicknamed their little red Corvette. So, but I got a kick out of it. So just finishing up on extravagance. So I'm reviewing my bill from the other night, and there's a $100 charge for McKellen cask. Can it be that worth it?
Again, if you love McKellen cask, yeah, it's, you know, listen, I mean, you know, Louis XIII is, you know, $400 a shot, you know. It's rare. If you want rare stuff, you know, if you want to buy a Picasso or a Basquiat, you're going to have to, you know, ante up, you know, because there ain't that many around.
But it goes back to this also. It's funny. I just am reminded of the trip down to Florida, and again, my friend was hosting his wife's birthday. And, you know, there was just, you know, whatever you want to order. And one person at the table had to order the special aged Grand Marnier because, you know, if it was on his dime, never would have happened. But it was on somebody else's, of course.
I see it all the time at holiday parties. You know, when it's on the bus, yahoo, man. They just go crazy, you know. And I guess it's just human nature, you know, getting away with something. I would always feel bad. You know, I go away with a friend of mine who play golf every year, and he's a beer drinker. He drinks Amstel Light. I don't, right? And sometimes that is pretty expensive. And I would, you know, I always make it clear because we split dinners. You know, I'll get one, he'll get one, I'll get one, whatever. But if I go on a tear, I always cover that myself. I would never stick him with, you know, an extra $100 in wine or $150 in wine when he's drinking, you know, $6, $8 Amstels or whatever. So I think it's just a character issue. I think, you know, either have some or you don't, you know. And I think, it's different levels. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, I think it's cheesy to stick somebody with a large bill. And it's the same thing with restaurants. I also think it's cheesy, you know, when you have these restaurant guys that come and they tell you the specials, they don't give you the price. What's with that? If you're embarrassed about it, maybe you should lower it or something. I don't get it.
Well, that's funny. You have brought that to my attention. And, you know, again, you're the restaurateur, and here you are, you know, being honest and critiquing, you know, a bad practice in the industry. But, yes, how many times is a special listed when somebody, you know, goes through, a server goes through the specials, and you don't think to ask?
No, I think the customer has the right to know.
But I want to go back into the restaurant experience, and I apologize to our listeners if this was addressed in a previous episode. But this thing about the 4% surcharge now if you are not paying with cash.
Yeah, that to me is a stupid practice. I think that if you want to piss people off, put it on your menu. If you want to cover it and not make anybody mad, you know, just blend it into your prices. I mean, that to me is a smarter way to go. I mean, if you raise all your prices 4%, so let's say you have, you know, a $62, you know, porterhouse on there. So you're going to raise it another $2.40 or whatever you're going to raise it. You know, I would rather do that, 62 to 64. Rather than announce this thing and make people mad. Some people.
Well, I clench my fist when I see it because I don't usually carry cash, so it just irritates me. But what's my observation, and again, I don't know if this is vindictive, but it's a traditional, as you would say, a red sauce pizza place. During COVID, You had to make a reservation to get a parking spot so they could bring the food out to you. You couldn't call in. You had to get on. They had one line. The line was used to order, to pick up, and it was just mass craziness. I mean, it just was, and there were people all over the place. And now they're still doing the surcharge there, but now there's nobody there. So what irritates me is, again, during the pandemic, a lot of businesses suffered. A lot of restaurants suffered. I guess that format of restaurant, the so-called red sauce pizza place, that's easily transportable food. It was nothing special to be able, you know, nothing out of the norm to be able to pack the food up to go. It's just normal stuff. The metal tins, or today's new version is those black bottom and clear top containers. But again, 3 months ago, you couldn't get in the door to order anything, and now there's nobody to be found. So I'm really confused about the times, and I don't know if, like, again, the lack of people was because it was 4th of July weekend, and that's not the go-to food for 4th of July. So,
yeah, it could be. You know, it's just everybody's trying to relearn what to do and try and figure this out. You know, this post-COVID thing with the health situation being the way it is, the economy, you know, seems to be tanking a little bit, and as far as, you know, prices are going up, everything's going up. It's just yeah, it's a weird time. It's a weird time.
It is a weird time. And then I go to order food, and there's a QR code on my table, and I don't know how to do anything. And I have to depend on somebody else to scan my QR code so I can see what's on the menu.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I went to a restaurant recently. It was the same thing. You know, you got to take a picture of it, and then it comes up, and it's, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's funny. I have these young 20-something-year-old hostesses, you know, trying to, you know, who are fairly inexperienced, can't get help, you know, trying to navigate the old reservation sheet and dining. It can be a little frustrating for, you know, somebody, you know, like myself, who knows, I can see what she can do right then, how she can get out of the situation she's in, and she just doesn't have the information. And I think everybody just has to be a little patient at the moment, you know, and I think in Long Islanders, you know, we're not a patient bunch when it comes to restaurants and seating. And I think some of it has to do with computers, you know, with this instantaneous, you know, information, and everything's like speed. If people aren't, you know, the second they get in, they start to get annoyed. It's crazy. And, you know, the restaurant's an inexact experience. I mean, if you have an 8 o'clock reservation Saturday night, you know, you're not the only one. There's going to be a few. And if we have to seat, you know, like 100 people at 8 o'clock, there's going to be some people who are going to be seated at 8:03, 8:04, you know. It's not a crisis. I think we've lost the perspective. You know, a catastrophe and an inconvenience. There's a big difference. But everything seems to be a catastrophe, you know. It's just
I have to give kudos to, I dined at for lunch yesterday at Patricia's over in, I guess it's Hop Hog, and the staff was just such a cooperative team. It just exuded, you know, the fact that they were really working as a team. You know, usually, you know, you get your bill and then your own server comes and picks it up. But there was another server walking by, saw that the credit card was there with the bill and picked it up. And everybody was just working interactively. And it was like a fine-tuned symphony. It really was. And when a restaurant gets it right, I think kudos to them, and people should appreciate it. And you know, it was running like a real Tom Shawdell joint.
Well, it's funny, you know, it's you know, when you see cooperative and well instructed and behaved employees, it's fabulous to watch. I mean, the other end of it is, you know, I had this big thing going on at the club, and I had to hire some, you know, some rental people, you know, temporary employees through this agency, and they're a bunch of kids, you know, and you know, you basically, and I've done it with the catering thing where I had a party for 600 one time 2 years ago out east, and I had to get people because they didn't have servers, and you spend half your time looking for them, you know, because they're ditching over here to having a cigarette, who's on the phone, who's texting their friends, they're ducking behind the restrooms. It's, you know, so I have this bunch of kids, and, you know, we have 900 people out there trying to eat, and I got five of them around the there's a seltzer machine in the kitchen there, water and seltzer, and they're all talking like it's, you know, the office on Monday morning around there, you know, water. I'm saying, listen, if you have no business in the kitchen, go back outside. You know, they need you outside. And so this one kid says to me, well, but it's hot out there. I'm like, you know, I'm over it. It's hotter in here. And it's going to, you know, one more answer like that, it's going to feel hot in here, right? So I send him outside, and there's this, like, 18, 19-year-old something girl who decides that she's going to be F. Lee Bailey and defend the guy. I don't think you should be talking to us like that. Who do you think you are? Yelling at me, right? Like, you know, if you put half the energy into working and you put into lawyering, you know, you'd be a fairly mediocre waitress. Right? I'm saying, like, listen, and she keeps it up. And I'm like, I think you should get out of the kitchen in a battle of wit. You're seriously underarmed here, you know, and I don't want to get stupid with you. So just get out of here. And all the way out, she's like talking back and, I mean, just total lack of
hate. The world is definitely different.
It is.
Because in what I keep seeing now, you know, everybody talks about podcasts, and technically we're a podcast also, but when people are listening, I'm finding that all the young people today have these wireless ear pods. They're listening to either music or podcasts or whatever, but there's one missing link. They're doing this on the employer's time. So people are not 100% concentrating on what they're supposed to be doing. They're doing, maybe it's not that important to pay attention with washing dishes or something, but, you know, if somebody's on a skilled a cutting machine or something, but nobody's concentrating anymore. They're multitasking, but I don't think it's productive multitasking.
Well, I also think that once you've given trophies for coming in 13th, you know, you've and told everybody they're perfect in everything they do and they're wonderful and they're a gift to humanity and, you know, nobody's like you and you're unique and, yeah, okay, fine, but you've ruined a generation because you can't criticize anybody. They're so not used to it that they recoil in horror that you could possibly think that they weren't perfect at what they're doing. So nobody's striving to get better at anything. I mean, I had a guy, I have one of the runners who, you know, he's a very nice guy, this guy, and you know, all he does, he's on his phone all day. You know, he's not paying attention. Stuff that's supposed to be going on isn't going on. Stuff that's not supposed to be going on is. And I said to him, finally, I said, you know, you are not going to train me to not care about this. So you're going to have to start giving a you-know-what, or you're not going to be able, you know? I said, I don't understand. I mean, I do the same thing for a buffet that we do all the time, and you just can't get everything out there. Do you need a flashcard, a cheat sheet? You know, what do you need, you know? Do I have to put it on your phone? But you are. But that's what you deal with, you know?
And so that be said,
to the original point. When you see some, you know, a bunch of employees that are really doing a good job, it stands out in your mind, you know?
For sure. And that be said, we are indeed at the end of the show.
All right. So we're going to close with Tom's Three Keys to Life, clumsily. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we will see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients: Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming, personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.